This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today I'm speaking with Paul Zane Pilzer, one of Utah's most successful serial entrepreneurs. Pilzer made his first $1 million in his 20s, and over the next 30 years, he went on to start multiple companies, including Zane Publishing, which he took public in 1995, and Extend Health, which sold in 2012 for over $400 million. He served as an economic advisor to Ronald Reagan. He taught for 21 years at New York University. He's written several books, and he's been on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Paul, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Thank you, Doug. It's great to be here.
So let's start at the beginning. Tell us the story. How did you earn your first $1 million in your 20s? And I'm guessing that was in the 80s, and $1 million was real money back then. How did you do that?
All right. I guess I technically, had, meaning no debt, and I owned it, $1 million cash when I was 25, and I started at 22. And I started on a pattern that was to become a lifelong pattern of entrepreneurship. I was an unhappy, unsatisfied customer. I had graduated business school and went to work at Citibank. And when you move into New York City, everyone talks about their summer share they're going to get in the Hamptons. I didn't know what the Hamptons was.
And where did you have a summer share?
Right. And I had grown up on Long Island. I thought the world just ended at the end of the Long Island Expressway. There was this whole world of beach homes. So I go out there and say, wow, look at these homes with all these young people and pretty girls. I want to join one of these houses. So the thing you did to get in a home was each weeknight while living in Manhattan after Citibank, I would go to a party at someone's apartment where they'd have pictures on the wall of this beautiful house on the ocean with tennis courts, they had beautiful girls all over the place. And they said, join this house and get a share. You get a bedroom or half a bedroom and come out for the summer. So I said, deal, I'm in. Never called me back. I went to the next home the next day. Deal, I'm in. Never called me back. The third house I went to visit, really great apartment. And I said, this is terrific. This is just for me. I work at Citibank. Bingo, never call me back. I was an incredible nerd. I was 22 years old and looked 12 and had the maturity like I was going on 10. So, of course, when I showed up, these people said, so what? He works at Citibank and he went to business school and he has the money to pay. We don't want him in our house. We want cool people. I didn't know that then. I just knew that I would say yes and they wouldn't call back. So I went out to the Hamptons to look at some of these homes, and I rented one, a whole home with 12 shares, six-bedroom house. Now I had to pay for the house, so I started looking for people to come in my house. But I didn't have time to find cool people. I needed to find people who needed a home. Who were they? People who had good jobs, people who went to good schools, people who, frankly, weren't cool. Didn't look cool, didn't smell cool, didn't act cool, just like me. So I filled my six-bedroom house with 12 nerds. And everyone tells you when you go to sell something, buyers are liars. They all say, yes, Mr. Pilzer, yes, Paul, I want to be in your home. Then you go to try to collect the $2,000. It's a whole different story. So I would notice everyone would say they want to be in my home, but didn't want to be in. What happened? Come Memorial Day weekend in May, I go to look at the shares I got, and I have sold not the 12 shares I have, but 25 shares. I oversold. And everyone was saying yes, and they were actually ready to fund because whatever deal they were working didn't happen. I ran back out to Southampton. I rented a second home on the same street, and all of a sudden I had two houses. The next year I had 24 homes, and I had developed a scalable model. I would go for Citibank to Harvard Business School, Stanford Business School, Chicago Law School, and I'd hire people to join Citibank. Then I'd say after I gave them the job offer, do you want a summer share in the Hamptons? They go, yeah, now that I got a job, but I don't have time to get it. I go, sign here. You can have the master bedroom of this house for free if you fill the other six bedrooms with other University of Chicago graduates who are moving to New York. I had a network. All of a sudden, I had 24 houses. The houses were spitting off $4,000 or $5,000 positive cash flow a year times 24 homes. I only made $20,000 working at Citibank and made $125,000 a year in positive cash flow. Then I started buying and building the homes, and I actually was able to build a house on 1 acre with a pool and a tennis court for $99,000 back in 1976. I could get Citibank to finance it, or if you worked for a bank, the bank would give you a no-interest, no-fee loan. That was a deal you got as an officer. And I ended up with 24 homes, and then some of the homes went way up in price, and I decided time to sell them. All of a sudden, I had $1 million cash, and I was 25 years old.
That's bizarre. They say to do what you love, and the money will follow. Oftentimes, that's not true, but in your case, it was.
But it set up a pattern that when you're an unhappy customer, you can get two things. You can get angry, or you can get wealthy. When you're an unhappy customer, you can found a business serving other unhappy customers of that particular business, or you can get mad. I prefer to get rich.
And you had fun along the way. So your first venture outside of the bank in 1981, you started a real estate development firm, Zane May Interest, which was in the real estate field. Tell us how you ended up with that partnership, and that was in Texas, right? So how did you go from your real estate empire in the Hamptons to starting to build something in Texas?
Well, there's multiple stories there, so I have to, and I always tell the truth, but it's whether you tell the complete truth and how complete you keep going and how much detail. What happened there was in January 1981, I was at Citibank investing equity money in large real estate projects on behalf of people like Marcos, Khashoggi. These were heads of state known as despots or dictators. They gave their money to Citibank. Citibank recommended they buy real estate. My job was finding the real estate investments, and I was pretty good at it. I worked hard. I bought shopping malls, bought high-rise office buildings, apartment buildings, all on behalf of large, wealthy, very wealthy foreign investors. In January 81, I had beat someone out for a deal who was chairman of a big, well-known, multi-billion dollar family. And he came to visit me at Citibank. And he said, we got a problem. We have five shopping malls in about $100 million in equity, worth about $400 million equity in debt in the United States. And we've financed them 200-300%, which means if they had put in $80 million, they've taken out already $240 million. And that's very key, because that means even if they get foreclosed on, they'd have a capital gain of $240 million.
Right. They've already won.
They've already taken all the money out, non-recourse. Right. And we want to do tax-free exchanges. And you've written this article as a lecturer at New York University on tax-free exchanges. And people tell us around the law firms of New York that the most skilled person on the accounting law, the whole package, in structuring a 1031 tax-free exchange with very large asset real estate is you. So we know you can do this with Citibank and we could hire you, but we'd rather hire you personally, not hire you at Citibank, and you come join us. And I said, I'm not for hire. And the guy says, let's get real direct here. He takes out his little checkbook. He says, here's a blank check. It is now 6:30 p.m. on a Monday night. I have to leave here by 7:10 p.m. to get in my car to drive to my plane to fly from LaGuardia back to my family in Chicago so I can put my daughter to bed, which I promised her I would do tonight. I'm going to do that. That leaves us now 38 minutes to figure out how much I put on this piece of paper. No documents, no things. I trust you. We handshake a deal. I hand you this check. You can wait till the check clears tomorrow morning and you work for me. Now all we got to do is figure out the amount, and we just wasted 5 minutes. We only got 33 minutes left. Let's figure it out.
So what was the number on the check?
It doesn't sound right now, but you have to add 10 times to this. At the time, I earned at Citibank, I had been there 5 years. I was a vice president. I earned $39,000. I had started at the top of my Wharton class at $20,000, and they had doubled my salary in 5 years.
So you were feeling pretty good. Right?
$39,000 I made. My father's best year in his life, he never made half that. And I was 27. And what happened? He gave me $100,000. And I didn't believe the check would clear. My parents didn't believe it would clear. My father said, the money's really good and you're really sure, then you can quit the bank.
If you're just joining us today, I'm speaking with Paul Pilser, serial entrepreneur and author. And so Paul Pilser moved to Texas.
Right. And I started as an entrepreneur with only $100 million. I had five shopping malls, $100 million in equity. My job was to sell them, pull out the equity harvested, do tax-free exchanges, and build a little real estate company.
And this was a partnership. You weren't an employee, right?
No, I was an employee. The deal I made with them is on the $100 million of equity in the shopping centers, once I had turned it over and got it into stable sale-leaseback, more stable investments, at that point, I got 10% of the profit above prime. Prime was 21.5%. Let me say that again. Interest rates were 21.5% was prime. Treasuries were 18, 19%. So whatever I earned over 21.5, I got 10% of. Long story is I made them $300 million. I made $3 million. That was 12 months later.
Okay. And let's keep going. I mentioned in the opening, you're a serial entrepreneur.
So at 28 years old, I said, I'm never going to work again, Dad. I have $3 million in the bank. Life is over. I don't know what I'm going to do. I think I'm going to teach at NYU full time, which is where I ended up for the next 21 years, teaching at NYU. But I still stayed as an entrepreneur.
Right. And while doing that, in 1989, you started another company, this time in the education space, Zane Publishing.
Right.
Tell us what Zane did and why did you switch from real estate to education?
Okay. The real story of how I started that was in 1975, my thesis in Philadelphia at the University of Pennsylvania was an interactive teaching machine on a mainframe computer. And I had built a mainframe computer that in those days used to spit out like teletype, and it would spit out a question: is when was the Federal Reserve started and how did it start? And then based on the ABCD answer you put in, it would teach you more and then ask another question. And people would come and marvel at the computer center at UOP, the same computer center, by the way, in building where ENIAC, the first digital computer, was built in 1944. And they would say, this is amazing. This is the future of education. This technology, Mr. Pilzer, will let us scale teachers the way phonographs have scaled singers and the way motion pictures have scaled actors. Teachers will become famous if they're really good because this technology will scale them. Of course, that didn't happen, but that's what you thought it was.
Still hasn't happened to this day, unfortunately.
And that's what I spend most of my time on now. So that was my dream, which is still my dream, to use technology to take great teachers and let them scale, let them be like singers or actors or motion, people that can make a lot of money, but more importantly, affect millions of students, not hundreds of students. And that's what I wanted to do all my life. And all the time I was at Citibank and making money in real estate, I was learning all the rules of real property. But what I really wanted to be in was intellectual property, and specifically intellectual property in education. I looked at the media value of all the textbooks, all the books that are read in elementary schools around the country, and there's only three states that dominate that business, and said, this is like a channel that everyone learns. I want to own this stuff electronically. I want to add value to it. I want to use technology to scale the teachers.
And back then, no one was using any technology in education. It was really a chalkboard and a teacher at the front of the room, and that was it.
And I'm smiling. Most people would argue it's still pretty much the same when you go into most elementary schools.
Well, they have a whiteboard now.
Right, but there's no choice. You send your kid to school. It's a total black box. When things go wrong, you get to change schools. But you never get what you get on Amazon. Before you buy something, you know everything about it. After you buy it, you know when it's coming, you know what it's like, and you write your review. How can we live in a world where you send your child off for 7 hours a day to school and you don't have a report of everything they did that night? I don't know, but somehow we do. Well, let's move past that.
See, I know you've got a lot of passion for education, and you and I have been friends for many years. And you've shared with me your views on public education. You're a big supporter of public education, but I wanted to give you a few minutes to chat about your views on public education and the role it plays in our communities.
Public education is if you had to say one thing that made the U.S. so successful and made us the most powerful nation on earth, it's public education. Because it allows somebody born to the right of the bell curve, be it right meaning they're better artists, they're better singer, they're better mathematician, whatever they are, they're a little abnormal. Or let's put it another way, God gave them more gifts in that field than he gave another child. And if that person can actualize the gifts, we all live really well. From unlimited food, singing, housing, everything. Right. Everything we own is somebody was born a little bit to the right, meaning better than someone else doing something, from the first caveman or through a spear. And when we find those people and nurture them and get their talents, we get very rich as a society because they contribute technology and better methods. And public education was the first time in the history of the world, United States public education, which started in 1888 in the state of Michigan, where we determined, the Supreme Court of the United States determined, you could use public money, tax the farm next door, to educate kids on a different farm. Of course, we'd all benefit if everybody was educated. And that model of letting anyone who God developed with more talent actualize is the history of the United States, the main success of the United States. And it's a tragedy now that 5 million kids in America go to private school. Not that the private school's not good for them, but we're missing those parents in the public school. I was once asked, this builds back to the story, in 1989, I was pretty cocky and I thought I was going to be Secretary of Education. I had worked for the President of the United States 5 years. I was pretty sharp. I was a famous award-winning professor at New York University. I had written number one book in the United States, Other People's Money, with Simon Schuster. What else would I be besides Secretary of Education? Because I was too young to be president. And of course, that's not what happened. I got my interview. And when I got my interview with White House personnel in December 88, thinking I was going to be in January 89, the new education secretary, they laughed at me. They said, Mr. Pilzer, what are you, 30 years old? And I said, no, I'm 34. I got to get moving. And they go, relax. You don't have to be a cabinet officer. We'll make you an assistant secretary of education. We'll create the position for you. And I said, I wouldn't take a number two position. I'm Paul Pilzer. And they said, you should do this. And I said, look around. And I rattled off Schultz, David Stockman, all the people who had made cabinet officers at 31, 32. And when I said that, the head of White House personnel said, don't you get it, Professor Pilzer? those people were congressmen when we appointed them. You're just a businessman. I said, I know. I've employed thousands of people. I've built America. I'm not some blood-sucking congressman. And the White House personnel person said, I think the president and President Reagan would probably agree with you. But my job is to get people here who have had the test of time, been elected, and have survived the election, and now we make them cabinet officers, because that's what we did back then with Republican congressmen, because it was a democratically controlled Congress.
Let's circle back to your
relationship. Let me finish that one item.
Okay.
8 months later, my phone rang. Same guy. He says, watch the news tonight, Mr. Pilzer. Your congressman is resigning in Dallas, Texas. If you want to run for Congress and then take a job here as Secretary of Education, we will give you the full backing of this office. That means President would come and campaign for me, which is exactly what happened. And I ran for Congress the following year, and I lost by 6,000 votes of 600,000.
Ouch. Ouch.
Okay. And I outspent my incumbent 8-1, and I still lost.
We're going to circle back to working with Ronald Reagan. But now I want to get back to Zane Publishing. So What did Zane Publishing do?
Okay. So Zane Publishing in 1989, when I didn't get the Secretary of Education job, I had become enamored with the CD-ROM. Because in those days, computers were used just to manipulate your own information. You bought a computer. It didn't come with anything but a word processor and a spreadsheet program.
And CD-ROMs were very rare in 1989. It really wasn't until 93 or 94 that it started to take off.
CD-ROMs came out in 85, went on computers in 89. They were never standard. But a CD-ROM, and that's the big difference, instead of using a computer to take your input, put it in and manipulate it, use the computer to get information. There was no internet. That was radical. You could put a CD-ROM in a computer with, in my case, it had all the transcripts of the Larry King Live TV shows, my first CD-ROM, and I was on three of those shows, so I had my transcript on one little CD. And then there was a CD Microsoft did, Multimedia Beethoven. I could go on forever, but basically I said, this is amazing. I can publish all the world's knowledge on these glass discs called CDs, and I formed Zane Publishing to become a CD-ROM publisher versus a book publisher. And the first CD I published was all of my books and all of Tony Robbins' books combined with a beautiful guide to get through them all, and Tony and I spent an hour each telling people what was on the disc. That disc was called Multimedia Power Talk. It made the cover of PC Magazine, then the most popular magazine in the United States, and that launched my CD-ROM publishing world. We ended up building it to 1,000 CDs. We became the world's largest educational CD-ROM publisher. Company went public in NASDAQ on 95, and I had a time of my life. I had 100 editors at any given time building a disc. And they would take all the knowledge in the world about freshman psychology, coupled with the number one book about freshman psychology, and publish it.
So after Zane Publishing let's fast forward to 1999. CD-ROMs have come and gone. By 1999, they're old school. The internet. Everything's on the internet. Every time you turn on the television, there's a dot-com commercial. Dot-com millionaires are being minted by the day. You look at that huge opportunity and you say, I'm going to start my next company. But when you looked at that, you said, I'm going to start my next company in health. Your next company was Extend
Health. Actually, no, I got a detour. I got married. My wife was pregnant. And we decided to move our main residence from our beach house, which was our main home in California, to our ski home in Park City. So in 1999, I became a legal Utah resident. And that's when I ran into an accident. My health insurance got terminated. Because the health insurance I had at the time came from my serving on the board of a top 10 Wall Street firm. And my very deal with the board of directors of the firm for 20 years was, I'll serve on your board of directors, you pay me a little bit of money, and you give me health benefits. That was the deal. Well, they don't offer health benefits in Utah, so when I legally moved from California to Utah, I lost my health benefits, and I went into panic mode. I said, this is crazy. If my baby, my wife's baby, is born early, called a preterm baby, they'll keep it alive. And they'll try to keep it and survive for at least 60 days at $60,000 a day. Do the math. $60,000 a day, they keep the baby alive 60. That's $3.6 million, which I don't know if anyone of you knows had a preterm baby. They go, so what? What's the story? Well, the story is that I was good then for the $3.6 million,
right.
But I didn't have health insurance, but I wasn't looking forward to spend $4 or $5 million. And then I found out that I might even lose my doctor in hospitals that my wife liked, because even though I had money to pay, I was going to fall out of network and not be able to pay. And that's when I lifted my head up in 1999. I go, what happens to other people like Paul Pilzer who don't have money and just move from one state to another and lose their health insurance? And I found out that there are 2 million personal bankruptcies filed in the U.S. each year. 1 million of them are caused by employer health insurance that got canceled through some twerk of the thing that it didn't have, that it didn't go along. And when they lose their health insurance, these are mostly people with college degrees, earning well over $7,500 a year, real jobs, salt of the earth people. They lose their health insurance, they go bankrupt.
It's a travesty that still happens today.
Still does. So I said, what do I do? Well, I solved my problem. I solved my problem by finding that by moving to Utah, there was a vibrant individual insurance market. It was too late to solve it for the first pregnancy because it didn't cover pre-existing conditions. But it covered the next three babies we had, covered my family. And I said, there are other people who need this solution. I'll found a company to deliver this solution. Only instead of just buying your own individual policy, you'll get your employer to pay for it pre-tax through payroll. That company sold for $435 million 12 years later.
If you're just joining us today, I'm speaking with Paul Pilser, serial entrepreneur and author. And while you were running that, you actually started another company in the healthcare field.
Yes.
Zane Benefits. Tell us about Zane Benefits.
Well, Extend Health's model was give your employees money to buy their own health insurance and then help them buy it. It sold insurance. And Extend Health was wonderful. A lot of other people joined it, but it really served major companies. Our first customer was 27,000 white-collar Ford employees. Then they moved on to John Deere. All of a sudden, we got the retired auto workers, and we were very good at lots of service of very large companies.
So why was your first large customer Ford? Didn't all those people have healthcare coverage from Ford?
Yes, and I could show them a better way to do it, but it actually wasn't Ford. It was Walmart. When I wrote a book in 1991, Sam Walton endorsed the book and made it standard issue at Walmart. That was called Unlimited Wealth. And I went down to Arkansas to meet with the Walmart people, and I found as the largest insurer in America, 2 million employees, 1 million people in the group plan, they would explore anything. They were interested in talking. And they were intelligent enough, and they were large enough to have staffers, not just line people, who said, let's listen and talk about this. And so I worked with Walmart. And then finally, after 3 years, Walmart said, we can't do this politically, give our employees money to buy their own health insurance. But I want you to meet here this new man. He's the president of Sam's Club. And Sam's Club has 8 million small business members. And I lit up. I love small business people. That's my friends. That's me. Even though I built some big companies, I think of myself as the first day I incorporate each company myself, the first day I hire the first employee. That's what I love doing, small companies. And Sam's Club had 8 million of them. And when they filled out the survey every year what they like and don't like about Sam's Club, the number one dislike was that Sam's Club didn't sell health insurance to small business because that was their big need.
And you sold health insurance.
I sold health benefits to small business that allowed their employees to go anywhere they want and buy what they want, whether it be Airbnb or like any other model. You give some of the money and let them go make a decision, and the powers that be get very upset. Call it a disruptor strategy. I don't know if I like disrupting as much as I like serving people, but certainly they go hand in hand. So we developed a model, and that was Zane Benefits, that really serves small companies. Our original model, Extend Health, served very large companies. That's why it sold for $435 million. Zane Benefits was focused on 2 to 20-person companies. And my very first company, my guinea pig, was a 20-employee company called Skull Candy here in Park City.
Really?
And the second was the Park City Art Museum, and the third was Soaring Wings School. And as you run around Park City and talk to business owners, you'd be surprised how many, all three of those I have permission to mention, who have said, I don't have a group health plan. I give my employees money. They're real happy, tax-free, and they buy their own health insurance.
Well, let's talk about this. The employees are happy, but it has been controversial, what you do at Zane Benefits. You were on the cover of the Wall Street Journal in 2007, talking about Zane Benefits. And just a couple weeks ago, the New York Times ran a major story about Zane Benefits. What's the controversy?
The controversy, well, the truth or the nonsense? The truth is, when you give people their own money to go make their own decisions, which I believe is a God-given right and part of America, there's somebody who is controlling that money. I call it blood. And he doesn't like to bleed. He liked taking one guy to lunch and getting 1,000 employees to get health insurance for. He doesn't want to meet them. He doesn't want to know their kids' names. He doesn't want to do any work. That's a lazy health insurance broker. There are some good ones. There are some real lazy ones. And throughout the world, whenever technology comes along, it breaks down barriers. This wasn't possible without computers and technology and the internet. And now that you can efficiently let people make a choice about having a guest in their extra room in their home, or driving a car to the airport and filling the empty seat with someone interesting that they want to drive there. And once technology allows that, it breaks down rules and barriers and people get upset. So ultimately, what's behind all the controversy with my health benefits companies is Zain Benefits, the only one I have an interest in today, doesn't sell health insurance. Say it again. We never sell health insurance. We don't sell health. I can't say it enough. We give software to an employer that lets them give money to employees who then buy their own health insurance.
What does the software do for the employer?
The software is actually a big payroll module. It lets the employee sign on and see that he's getting $300 a month as an allowance. It lets the employee pick through different portals, carriers, any type of health insurance, go to healthinsurance.gov, the new federal website, buy his policy, and tell his employer to reimburse him tax-free for it. And to try to put this in perspective, when I worked at Citibank in the 70s, we had 300 employees just in compliance on our health care plan. Just to fill out the state and federal forms for 100,000 people, 300 people came to work in the compliance department. Our software charges an employer $12 a month per person, does all the work those 300 people did 30 years ago.
So right now, you guys are in a really nice space. I know your company's growing very nicely. Things are going really well. But like with most startups, it wasn't always that way. You went through some tough times.
Absolutely.
I know that you worked for several months, if not years, without a salary.
I've still never had a salary.
I've been the CEO
for 8 years.
But there's other people on your team, executives like Allison Wissner, who worked for you for many months without a salary,
right,
really because of the commitment to the company, maybe even a year or two. Ultimately, Allison helped you out a great deal there, and she's gone on now to be a very successful venture capitalist at Mercato Partners. How important was it to you during those tough times to have people like Allison Wissner on your team?
Well, more than Allison, the president of the company, who was on the front page of the business section of the New York Times 3 weeks ago, he's 29 years old now. I hired him when he was 21 years old. He's done nothing but this for 8 years since graduating Duke University. Now he makes a lot of money. But when he came at starvation wages. When things got rough, he was the first one to cut his salary and work with me day and night, 7 days a week. It's not really salary. It's salary or equity. In every business I start, I always need a team, like a team to get this rocket ship from here to there. And I go, how many of you have some expenses? Got a wife who's pregnant at home, got a mortgage, got a house. Great. So if you join us, we got to come up with $80,000 a year to feed you. Yeah, I guess I do. And you don't have any expenses, right? Or your brother's willing to lend you money, or you're willing to go move in with someone. That's my favorite person. That person's willing to work for equity. Now, I hire both because we need good people. And depending on their circumstances in life, some get a salary, some get equity. The ones who get equity get very rich, but they're taking a big risk. They may not get their salary. And I've told my young students, try to get yourself in a position that you don't need a salary. Because me as an entrepreneur, I'm older. I come from a background that I would never take a penny in salary before my investor had all their money back. Because not all my deals work out. But when they don't work out, you know what they look at? Oh, there's the president who made $200,000 a year,
right,
while it didn't work out. I have never taken a dime from a company before everyone who put money in that company made all their money back and then some, and then I'm entitled to a salary.
This concludes the first part of my interview with Paul Zain Pilzer. Be sure to join us next week to hear the rest of the conversation. The Bottom Line was recorded at KCPW Studios on Library Square. It was produced by Ross Chambliss with technical support by Jesse Ellis and Tyler Ford. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.